Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. I will open up an organizational meeting. This is the first meeting for the February session, and what we have to do is adopt rules for the committee. Because we have a lot of people here today, I'm just going to ask everybody to just introduce themselves, and then we're going to go ahead and adopt the rules, and then we'll move on to our first bill, which is Senate Bill 1510. I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder. I represent Northeast Southeast Portland. It's an honor and a privilege to chair this committee again. And I'm serving my first term in the Senate, and I served four terms in the House. And have fabulous committee members and staff, and I will ask the staff to introduce themselves quickly at the end as well. And I'll pass it on to my vice chair.
I'm vice chair, Senator Alan Olson from the heart of Clackamas County, Canby, Oregon City, Gladstone, beautiful area to live. I've been a senator for just a year now, and it's an honor and privilege to serve as the vice chair of this committee.
Mark Hass, I'm from the Beaverton area. Been a couple years on this committee. I vote the way Alan tells me to.
Okay, so we'll move on to Senator Thompson. We also, levity is, you know, really valued in this committee.
Well, we try to have fun. It's not that easy being on this committee, you know. I'm Chuck Thompson from Hood River. My district goes from Hood River to Clackamas Town Center out around the Mount and Estacada area. I cover three counties, Hood River, Clackamas, and Multnomah County. And I'm serving my first term, still learning a lot. There's a lot to learn in this business.
And next we'll hear from the senior member.
Oh, you're so flattering. Senator Floyd Prezonsky, serving districts, the District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. It's my honor and privilege to be again on the Natural Resources Committee. And Madam Chair, I'm here to do the work.
I expect that of everybody, of course. And speaking about doing the work, I am very pleased that our committee staff, Beth Petrino, is back. And
I am Beth Petrino. I'm staffing this committee and the House Energy, Environment, and Water Committee this session.
And Sue, thank you for being here. And Sue, make sure that everything runs smoothly. Without her, we would be lost. So with that, I will open up a work session for the adoption of the committee rules.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2/2/2012.
Okay, Senator also moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2/2/2012. Is there any discussion? I'm assuming everybody's had a chance to look at those. Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Prezonsky?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. With that, the motion passes. The rules are adopted. I'll close the work session on the adoption of the committee rules, and we'll start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1510. And Beth, if you could provide an overview.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1510 directs the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to report to the Legislative Assembly on or before February 1st of 2013 on the development of a work plan and receipt use of monies to carry out the Marine Reserve statutes. It further directs ODF&W and the State Land Board to implement particular recommendations of ODF&W on Marine Reserve boundaries and allowances by adopting rules. There is no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact statement. You should also have in your packet in front of you a number of emails and written testimony that have been submitted for the record.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to ask Ed Bowles from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up. We have a number of people that would like to testify, so I just want to let folks know how we're going to do this hearing because we have a lot of work to do today. We're going to have the department provide an overview. The Coastal Caucus, which is several House and Senate members that have been working on this for many, many years, along with many folks in the audience, the governor's office, folks on the coast, throughout the state, they're going to come up and talk about their perspective. And then we'll take public testimony. If we have, I haven't seen the sign-up sheet yet. If we have a lot of people, we may need to limit the testimony to 2 minutes, I think we'll be okay. We've got about a dozen people. But we do have two other bills that we're hoping to hear today as well. So just want to give folks an overview of how we're going to proceed. With that, I think we have some slides to provide the background on this. Thank you. And take it away.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Pleased to be able to just provide a brief summary of Senate Bill 1510. And I'm going to just cover basically four key areas. The background, sites for designation, reporting requirements, and the implementation. For that background, I'm not going to take you all the way back because of brevity. This has actually been a decadal process for the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. Really, this recent part of it was really initiated through Executive Order 0807 in March of 2008, and really provided the sideboards for the current process, and that was to develop 9 or fewer sites and make sure they lived within the boundaries of being ecologically meaningful, yet avoiding significant socioeconomic hardship. And the Ocean Policy Advisory Council went ahead and solicited proposals for that, and there was a total of 20 proposals covering 10 distinct areas of the coast, and all told had a footprint of nearly 50% of the territorial sea. Now, from that, OPAC winnowed this down to just 6 areas, and of that, there were 2 pilot sites, one at Otter Rock and Redfish Rocks, 3 other areas for further evaluation at Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua, and then an area for developing potentially a new proposal at Cape Arago, South Coos Bay. House Bill 3013 from the 2009 session, sponsored by the Coastal Caucus, passed to really provide the framework for the process of evaluating the 3 new sites that are really part of the bill today. And we were told to designate the pilot sites, the 2 areas, get those completed and implemented, and then further evaluate these 3 sites, engaging community teams and a very rigorous public process in considering these. Consult with both the science component of OPAC as well as OPAC itself, and then report to the legislature, and that's the component, those recommendations that were part identified in this bill. So that brings us to Senate Bill 1510. So basically, you saw from that original footprint of the 20 proposals that OPAC was dealing with, this is the current marine reserves and marine protected areas that are contemplated within Senate Bill 1510. This represents a continuing to implement the Otter Rock and Redfish Rock sites. It implements the Cape Perpetua, Cascade Head, and Cape Falcon sites developed through those processes and consistent with those boundaries recommended by OPAC. Use local resources, and part of what the bill directs us to do is using local resources as best possible for implementation, of delaying the prohibitions until after we get baseline data collected, reporting both on the work plan and on any sort of funding or expenditures we've received before next session, and then reporting on the overall results of the Marine Reserve experiment after 10 years of study. So that's really the key components of this bill. Now I want to talk just briefly about how we will implement Senate Bill 1510 if it is passed. We already have, as you heard from the fiscal statement, we've already got the budget through the 2011 session, so the budget and the spending limitation for this fiscal, the biennium. We'll initiate rulemaking during the spring and summer for the 3 additional sites. We will delay any prohibitions till after baseline data is collected for those 3 sites, and that's typically 2 full field seasons or more as scientifically required. We will continue to engage in very thorough public and stakeholder involvement throughout this whole process, both our rulemaking, development of work plan, and the implementation. We will use local resources, and by this, one example of that is using local vessels to charter captains and the vessels for the research itself. We will do that as best we can and as is practical and feasible. And we will work with federal entities as well as research entities towards trying to work towards providing additional fishing opportunities. And these include stock assessments, including localized information from these areas to try to help identify areas that have more robust populations of these sensitive species. Also, research into better methods to reduce not only the bycatch but also discard mortality associated with fisheries that all could help open up opportunities through the federal process, which is the Pacific Fisheries Management Council primarily, to provide additional fishing opportunities. We will report on the work plan and spending as well as any revenue received by next February. And then the Science and Technical Advisory Committee to OPAC will report on the results of this marine reserve experiment after 10 years to the legislature. So that represents not only the elements, but also the steps for implementing Senate Bill 1510. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife supports this bill, and I'm welcome to answer any questions if you'd like.
Great, thank you. And I think we're going to bring up, in the essence of time, because we have several members here who may have to get back to their committees, I think we're going to have the Coastal Caucus come up first, if you can stay on deck in case there's questions.
Okay.
You may have to just sit back there, and then we'll bring you up, because I think we only have four chairs. I see four members, so just stay close by.
Okay.
Why don't you come on up? Yeah. I hope we can have another chair up there.
There's.
Yeah. Okay.
We're good.
Great. Thank you all. And
girl, boy, girl.
Yeah, it's like nicely organized. Welcome. We have about half of the Coastal Caucus here.
Coordinate it. Boy, girl, boy, girl.
Yeah.
We are coordinated. The Coastal Caucus.
Yes. Whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, I've drawn the short straw. Members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I'm here along with my colleagues from the Coastal Caucus to talk about Senate Bill 1510. As you notice, we are a bipartisan, bicameral group. We represent the eight legislators who make up the Coastal Caucus. I have to confess up front, this is a difficult bill for me personally, because I disagree philosophically with some of my constituents on the right approach to deal with the issue of marine reserves. Many of them are in the room, and I presume you'll hear from them, and I'm going to come back to this point in just a second. Senate Bill 1510 is not a perfect bill. Environmental and ocean advocates will say it's too little. Fishermen and related businesses will say it's too much. Perhaps in our business, legislating, this represents the compromise that the Tillamook County Commissioners call for in their February 1st, 2012 letter. Senate Bill 1510 is the culmination of nearly a decade-long planning process at OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Committee. It began in earnest again in 2008 with an executive order from Governor Kulongowski. Senate Bill 1510, as you heard, is a minimalist bill. It calls to develop a work plan, start with research, working on previously appropriated money, begin in the South and move north, adopt rules to establish, study, monitor, evaluate, and enforce marine reserves. The marine reserves and marine protected areas described by OPAC and the work of the community teams are what are embedded in the bill. The physical designations affirmed by OPAC, those are the designations in the bill. Finally, it expresses a preference for local vessels and captains in pursuit of the baseline data. This is a point in mitigation of lost fishing grounds. And it requires a neutral academic and scientific evaluation and a report back to the legislature. This bill is merely a starting point. Interest groups have asked for amendments to this bill. Those amendments can be considered in 2013 as the baseline work begins. And finally, coming back to the disappointing philosophical difference that I have with some of my constituents, I absolutely believe that this bill is an inoculation against a ballot measure. You have seen the maps. This represents 5.5 of the territorial sea when we started with nearly 50%. A well-funded, perhaps East Coast-drafted ballot measure has the very real potential to tie up the whole Oregon coast. I have seen the maps in the public hearings representing as many as 32 marine reserves with interspersed marine protected areas. While some coastal residents object now, even though some testified in support before OPEC, I believe this bill protects the coast from economic Armageddon that could result from a ballot measure that imposes marine reserves on Oregon versus an Oregon public process that keeps this exercise to limited, generally agreed upon physical sites with appropriate sideboards to protect coastal economies. I hope you favorably consider this bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, representing the South Coast and also the chair of the Coastal Caucus. And we let Senator Johnson go first because she was gracious enough to use one of her two bills for our Marine Reserve bill, mostly because the rest of us had already used ours. But and the reason we chose to do that rather than use a committee bill is because we wanted to be able to demonstrate the solidarity of the Coastal Caucus by having all our names on the bill, which we were able to accomplish. This has been a struggle for us. And fortunately or unfortunately, this issue has consumed most of our thoughts and efforts as a group representing the coast for several years now. And quite honestly, Madam Chair, it's time to quit playing politics with it and get down to science. And personally, I think that's what this bill will allow us to do, is actually start the research. And you know, we were very mindful to not create something of our own, which we didn't. These are the OPAC recommendations, and in the bill are the actual sideboards recommended by OPAC as to what the size of both the reserves and the protected areas are, and we think that's very important. I also want to point out that we worked very closely with the governor's office on this to make sure that he would be on board. And at this point, I can say that he is. One of our sticking points was we actually considered having a sunset on this bill. There was an objection to that, so we kind of did a sunset light in the bill. And basically, that's to require a report back in 10 years to the Legislative Assembly when it's in session, which would hopefully compel the legislature at that time. Some of us probably won't be here then, but in fact, probably most of us won't be here then. But we felt that would compel them to take a look at it. Keeping in mind, Madam Chair, that for research of this scope, 10 years is a very short period of time. And our hope is at that point in time, we can at least make an assessment, the legislature can, as to whether this experiment is worth pursuing or whether we should abandon it. And to prejudge that determination at this point would be foolish. But for all of the politics that's gone on the coast, what we have not done up till now, all we've done up till now is talk about it. It's time we have our sights. Let's get the baseline data and let's start the research and base the first future discussions on what we do in the ocean based on real science. And that's what we've been after all the way through this. And I would also say, Madam Chair, that Ed Bowles talked about there are a few other things happening in the ocean at this point in time, and it's once we have this in place, then we can start talking about the C4 plan and wave energy and all these other issues that need to be brought into focus along with marine reserves. One of my frustrations is to talk about marine reserves in this conversation and wave energy in this conversation and what is the nexus. There has to be a nexus between all these things. Hopefully this will allow us to move into a broader discussion of the future of our ocean. So Senator Johnson's right, this is not perfect, but it is a baseline and it's a starting point, which is what we're after. The folks that have come to me and asked for additions or subtractions to this bill, my comment to them is come and see us in 13 when we'll have more time to look and see if there are minor adjustments we need to be made. But the fact is we need to get started now, and this allows us to do it.
Thank you, Senator.
And again, I would like to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. For the record, Representative Arnie Roblin, co-speaker of the House and District 9. The three people sitting next to me have been the stalwarts over the last year and a half of trying to get a bill that can work. And I came because I really want to make sure that people understand how hard Representative Cowan worked all last session as Coastal Caucus chairperson in trying to fashion a bill and talk to every constituent and every group out there to craft something. It, as was pointed out earlier, has not been an easy process for the Coastal Caucus. It was very difficult for us. We were not successful. In the interim between that session and here, Senator Cruz and Senator Johnson said, let us have an attempt at looking at this. We'll talk to people and see what we can do. And I wanted to make sure that we really understand, I think, the monumental task they did. And what they did was do something that is very simple. And that is, we pushed very hard from the Coastal Caucus to have a public process, the Oregon way of having a conversation about this up and down the coast. That took place, and recommendations were made, and we had agreed at the from the onset that after OPAC made a decision, we would help implement that. That's what we tried to do last session, and that's where we're here with you today. We took the essence of those, what were the marine reserves, we put those into this bill, and we said, here is the essence of what all of that public content was for the last 10 years. Here's what was agreed to by this group that's called OPAC, and here we are at Coastal Caucus, true to our word, working hard to implement those sites. I agree completely with Senator Cruz when we say it's about time to start getting the research and getting the work on the seafloor and in that sea column around those areas in and out so that we can make comparisons as we move forward. I think this bill does that. People will fight for this and that and whatever. What we did is bring it down to the basic components and said, now let's work together to implement this, gather the information we need, and in 10 years, see if we had made a difference. And I appreciate the efforts, and I'm thankful to be able to speak today.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative. Thank you. You get the last word of the Coastal Caucus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Representative Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I'm not here today to repeat what my colleagues have said. I'll just put an exclamation point on it. When we talk about how long we've been working on it, I walked into this room today and I recognize a good many of the folks who are waiting to testify. I'm absolutely certain that you will hear both sides of the spectrum in terms of liking or disliking the effort. And the other two other folks who are in the room today are Anna Packingham and Zach Reeves, both of whom have served as legislative fellows from Oregon Sea Grant, working as staff to the Coastal Caucus, trying to put this together. And neither of them are serving in that role now. They've both gone on to other positions, but that's how long and how hard we've worked on it. This isn't everything that everybody wants. This is a very basic bill so that we can move forward and utilize the funding that we were successful in putting into the budget last session, and I think that's very important. The funding is there. We need to move forward with the OPAC recommendations. This is the little piece of implementation language that we need in statute so that we can learn from the effort and figure out what's the right thing to do with the ocean that we all hold very dear, both from a perspective of wanting to preserve the ocean resources and the perspective of keeping our coastal communities working and, most importantly, providing the seafood that I really like to eat, but I don't fish for myself. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I just would like to say, first of all, it's really wonderful to see you all up there together. bicameral and bipartisan, because it doesn't always happen this way, as we know, in the legislature. But I do know the many years of work that's gone on, both in the Coastal Caucus, behind the scenes, with the department, all the folks who have come to probably hundreds of meetings to share their views, and people from not just the coastal area, but people from my district and districts throughout the state, I think, because we all view the coast as an amazing resource for the people of Oregon, and obviously it's not just a coastal issue, but the people of Oregon, this is a very important issue. But I did want to commend all the work for somebody who's been watching the Coastal Caucus, not as a member, but probably living alongside many of the hours and hours of work that you've put in, and obviously heard testimony in our committee over the years. Hopefully you can stay for some questions before we go on to the public testimony. We'll see if there's any questions for any of my members. Senator Olson?
Yes.
Okay.
I do have some, and this would be for anyone to answer if you would please.
And we may have, if we need to, we'll have Ed Bowles come up and answer if you guys can't answer it, but I have a feeling you probably can't.
Senator Cruz, I heard you mention that this bill is for 10 years. Is there a sunset on this bill?
No, there's no sunset on the bill, but you need to keep in mind, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that sunsets are very arbitrary things, and we put sunsets on lots of things in this process that never sunset. But what we did, which I think is maybe even more relevant, is we're requiring a report back to the Legislative Assembly when it's in session, which will get people's attention. And so I think, and quite honestly, the only reason we put a sunset in on the front end was because we felt that at a point in time, we needed to reassess the efforts and make a deliberative decision whether to move forward or not. So there's no sunset, but this report back requirement does fulfill that requirement, in our opinion.
Follow up. Senator Johnson, are there research dollars available now for this, and how much are they, and will they be available on the passage for immediate use?
Thank you very much for that question. I'm going to answer a portion of it at a very high level and then ask Mr. Bowles to dig down into the weeds by line item, basically. The answer is yes. There was money appropriated in the 2011 session, about $1.6 million.
$1.7 million.
That will be available immediately. Research is already underway and funds are being expended. I think the point that I would also like to make, while you have asked me about funds, because this is germane to the conversation, it's something that the Coastal Caucus worried about a lot, is the very pernicious possibility that outside money could flow into this process and thereby taint the outcome of research. For example, you would buy the answer that you wanted in research. We have done the very best that we can to inoculate against that occurrence. Any outside money that's received has to be received commensurate with an approved work plan. The legislature will have the opportunity to see that work plan. There will be public input in the development of the work plan. So there are appropriated dollars that are being spent right now. Anna or Ed can divide that down into what's being done on ecological research, on what's being done on socio and economic research. But I want to state not only the existence of money now, but also the prophylactic against having science outcomes purchased by outside money. And the department is well aware of that. The legislature will remain vigilant, and it will be an issue before the Coastal Caucus for the next decade.
Thank you. One follow-up.
Come back next year. And in February of next year, they have to report back.
Right. For anyone on the panel, and thank you for the work you've done on this, Governor Kulongowski stated that there would be no adverse impact on communities along the coast. Does this bill really satisfy that statement? And if it doesn't, how will we accomplish that?
I wouldn't mind addressing that, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. The conversation that came about in the early days of this discussion of a potential for some sort of marine protected areas was very concerning to the fishing and fishing-related industries up and down our coast. And it was the Coastal Caucus who brought that concern to then-Governor Kulongowski, at which point he invited representatives from the industry, all facets of it, shoreside and at sea, gathered around the table in the governor's office. The members of the Coastal Caucus sat with staff on the sides of the rooms and really literally didn't say anything, amazingly enough, for a group of legislators. And the governor must have given close to an hour and a half to those individuals listening to those concerns. That's where the executive order came from that outlined the concerns about socioeconomic impacts. And that has been in the forefront of our minds as we've moved forward all the way through this process is making those protections, and in the extensive community discussions that were held around the guidelines, the boundaries, there were adjustments made in the proposals so that particularly important fishing sites might be avoided, so that we could try to meet both the requirements of an adequate amount of protection, but make some adjustments from not just a marine reserve to a protected area that might allow a certain fishery, for example, crab, which is very sustainable, and that there were areas that were, some of those kinds of things were allowed. So that has been in the forefront of our mind all the way through as we've developed this, and I'm very confident that we've addressed it.
Madam Chair, if I may speak to that too. I think had we adopted into our proposed legislation the footprint that had come for Cape Falcon as it came, it would have excluded crab grounds. It would have excluded from take certain rocks. And in response to what was heard in the public meetings, the boundaries were moved and adjusted to become marine protected areas or to exclude certain rocks. So that has been in our minds, as Representative Cowan said. The other thing that I want to add is the health and vitality of coastal ports and coastal communities is something that is in our daily work. All of the members of the Coastal Caucus received a letter as late as yesterday from the Army Corps indicating that we had written in support of funding for the ports of Port Orford, Umpqua, and Garibaldi. We are asking for accommodation in their federal budget for the 2012 work plan. While the letter made no attestation as to whether or not that funding would become a reality, I offer this letter as testimony to the community, or to the committee, that we remain vitally interested in the economic health. I know from personal interest that the Port of Garibaldi has a very major proposal at the Connect 4 level, and I anticipate being an advocate for that funding to help work out their working waterfront. So we made adjustments along the way, and the economic vitality of those coastal communities is the economic vitality of the people we're privileged to represent. We take that trust very seriously.
Any other questions? Okay, just one last comment. Did you want to respond? I'm sorry.
Yeah, just briefly, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. I would also point out that as far as restrictions on fisheries, ODFMW has the authority to do that now. But this would be done in these areas based on a deeper level of science than we've ever had that happen before, and it will be done in consultation and with full knowledge of the Legislative Assembly as to what's going forward. So I think that's positive. And just one other thing I think I should note, we spent all last session on this bill, and we ourselves got trapped in the weeds of details. We honestly did. The governor, when we didn't get a bill passed, was seriously considering an executive order. Our conversations with the governor's staff, he didn't want to do that. He would have preferred that we do something, and we made a commitment that we would, and that's why we're here today. So this is the proper way to do it, and it's time. So I want to thank you all for your attention to this, and Senator Hass, I haven't forgot what I'm going to bring you. So. Okay. He asked for jam.
I was going to say, I'm not sure you want to say that on the record, Senator, but okay.
Plastic bag.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a jar of jam. It's nothing more. Yeah. And it's certainly less than 5.
We thought you were bringing some plastic bags, so sorry, just couldn't. The coastal folks will appreciate that. I want to thank you for your hard work on this. I know it's been a long road. I do want to I think I would be remiss if I didn't say that part of why you all and the legislature and the agencies and all the citizens have been involved in this is also not losing sight of why we're looking at this, which is to ensure the economic vitality, not just of this generation, but future generations of fishermen and people who love the ocean and ocean resources. It is a part of our heritage here in Oregon. So with all the discussion focused on the bill, just not losing sight of why we're doing this in the first place. And this is, like many, you know, it's an experiment. We've had marine reserves in a couple places around the country, but certainly I think the approach that you're forwarding is a wise approach, because until we have the science, we don't really know. And I think we will be looking anxiously. I'm not sure I'll be here in 10 years or any of the folks up here, but certainly be looking anxiously over the years of the results of that, of the research and that scientific data. So I appreciate all the work that you've done. I want to make sure that we remember that hopefully in the long run this will help boost the economic vitality of our coastal areas.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair, could I add one? Thank you. Thank you very much for your indulgence. I simply can't leave without putting on the record a reminder that our fishermen, our fishing communities are the protectors of the sea. I could lecture you for a long time, which I will not do, on the various gear modifications that they've made to make sure that their fisheries are sustainable and protected for future generations. It's incredibly important to our fishing communities that their next generations are able to continue, and they care deeply about that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you're welcome to stick around if you want to hear some of the other testimony. With that, we have about 7 people that signed up to testify, so I'm going to call you up. In the essence of time, it doesn't mean that you're all on the same side of the issue. I'm just going to read down the list and remind folks, if you have written testimony, please hand it to Sue. She'll hand it out to us, and I'm going to ask if you could summarize. Obviously, we can read it, but we'd like to hear your key points, and just it helps if you don't read it, but speak from the heart. We have somebody, Bernie Bork. Bjork, is that right? And I apologize. No, he isn't. Okay. And then I have Larry, who I can't read the rest of your handwriting, but your phone number is 503-949-2477. So if you have that phone number and it looks like Larry, come on up. No? All right.
We'll find you. We'll call it.
Yeah, we'll call you and call you up here. Lenora Lawrence? Would you like to, okay, you're going to pass. Okay, I'll just keep going. Doug Creasy. Is there Doug here? And then, was that you?
Yes, Terry.
Terry? Jeez, Terry.
It's catching sensitivity.
I like Terry. I'm sorry. You have to learn to write a little bit neater.
He's a fisherman.
We were about to call you. Okay, so Bernie, since I called you up first, why don't you go ahead and just a reminder to state your name for the record.
Senator.
And you have to speak into the mic. You don't have to speak that closely. They're pretty sensitive. Okay, thank you for coming here today.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder, the other senators. My name is Bernie Bjork. I am from Astoria, Oregon. Live at 36293 Bartolus Loop, Astoria. I am here representing the Lower Columbia Alliance for Sustainable Fisheries. It's a grassroots organization of over 100 fishing entities, that's commercial sport fishermen and the businesses that cater to them on both sides of the river. That's in Ilwaco, Chinook, and Astoria, Warrenton, basically, Hammond. What you got there is in my handout, I heard Senator Dingfelder talk about there's a few marine reserves around the country already. On the first page, you'll see in yellow what's called the Rockfish Conservation Area. And that is a closed-to-fishing area for our trawl fleet. And it goes from Canada to Mexico. And it off of Cape Falcon and Cannon Beach, it's approximately 30 miles wide. It's been there since about 2002 or 3. On the second page is the essential fish habitat area. It's in gray. It goes from the 700-fathom curve out to the 200-mile limit. That's about 140 to 160 miles wide, and that came about in about 2005. So those marine reserves have been there for quite a while already. And that's one of the major reasons the fishermen have said no. And our group has said no, 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 until some sort of mitigation. And that came out in our Cape Falcon Marine Reserve process. I was the commercial fisherman that represented the commercial fishermen from Clatsop County. And we finally got that put on at the very end, but you do need to know that a no marine reserve option was never on the table in that process. We fought for 11 months to get that on there, and we really never got it on there. We could not vote on a no marine reserve at Cape Falcon, ever. And I also need to tell you that process is flawed, very flawed, if you're a commercial fisherman or a recreational fisherman. It was basically a stack deck process from the beginning, and we didn't have a chance. And we basically had to defend ourselves at every meeting. And that's no way to run a process. The rest of the comment here, I have a letter in there that I wrote to Senator Johnson. I'd like you to read that. And also on the last page, two pages, a letter from Steve Bodner from the Coos Bay Trawlers Association. They just had the Cape Arago process down there out of the Port of Coos Bay. It was a much better run process than the team process for Cape Falcon, I assure you. So, anyway, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your testimony. Appreciate that.
Terry. My name is Terry Thompson. I'm Lincoln County Commissioner. And nice to see
you
again.
Sorry about your...
That's okay.
Called you Larry.
I've been called a lot worse recently.
I'm sure you have.
The coast of Oregon is about 360 miles long. 50 miles is all Lincoln County is. And under this proposal, we have three marine reserves expected to be put in our 50 miles. That seems an inordinately large amount to be put on one county. Now, I'm a neutral on marine reserves, but it doesn't seem like it's being shared very well amongst the state. It seems like Lincoln County's being forced to do the inoculation for the state of Oregon. There was a public process. I'm not against the public process by any means. I think there was a lot of concessions made. But it still winds up that the port that has the largest fishing fleet on the coast is taking the largest amount of protection area. And then you couple that up with the territorial sea plan, which no one can tell you exactly how that's going to result, but there's a proposal of state lands, and we don't know exactly where it's going to be, but I can see where the fishermen in our area are getting like the American Indians. We're getting pushed off the grounds by government. Now, that said, there's some things that bothers me about the process that's gone on this far. The two marine reserves that have been brought into place are Port Orford and Otter Rock. Now, I can't blame the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They don't have the funds that it takes. This is a very expensive endeavor you're stepped up to try to take on. They don't have the funds available. There's only so much manpower they have. And they've used most of that manpower, I believe, in Port Orford. Now, I'm not directly related there. I've watched some things go down in Otter Rock, not near what I'd like to see. One of the areas is baseline research. To me, baseline research in the near shore needs to be conducted on a quarterly basis, not just once a year. Most of the research that scientists have done over the years have been strictly summer science. Well, marine reserves in the near shore are very vulnerable to predation from lingcod and marine mammals in the winter months. So if you don't do that research in there at that point in time, you're not going to find out what the other half of the story is. And that's the kind of research it's going to take. That costs money, and it's hard to do because of the weather. So I encourage you, whatever you do in this process, make sure the baselines are conducted on at least a quarterly basis before you close the areas. The social impact statement, I believe there's going to be some social impact problems to the Port of Depot Bay up there. I want to make sure that you have good, clear guidelines about how complete a social impact statement is. And finally, the big one is, of course, how you implement these. In my mind, I think they need to be implemented systematically. You've kind of touched on it, but make sure it's clear that you don't overload the Department of Fish and Wildlife, because they've only got so much manpower. They've got to maintain the two they've already got and then take on a new marine reserve. Don't have them bring on three at a time. There's just no way we can afford to do that. Bring them on one, and then the next one, and then the next one, so that they have a chance to do the job, unless you guys find a lot more money than I think you've got in this legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My name is Doug Creasy. I'm from Garibaldi. I'm a salmon troller. And I just want to know that the testimony of the Coastal Caucus was quite infuriating to me. But I want to talk just about coho. Back in the 1990s, the fisheries, where coho was taken away from us to rebuild the stock. So for 10 years, we really didn't have a fishery, or 12, or actually 20. In 2002, the ODF&W signed a treaty with Canada, and that treaty tied us to the Thompson River. And the Thompson River is a tributary to the Fraser River in Canada. Well, I found this article written by Canadian biologists written in 1999, and it, well, one sentence, the productivity of wild Thompson coho has declined to the point which means populations are only able to replace themselves in the absence of any fishing. So ODF&W and Kitzhoffer, he was the governor at the time, tied my whole fishery to a system that had no fish, which basically meant for decades and decades there was going to be no coho fishery, and this is connected to North the Falcon fishery, forever. Because even as today, the Thompson River is not producing fish, and there's nothing we can do about it because it's in Canada. You know, so this was Kitzhoffer's deal, the government's deal, but the other thing too is that the Thompson River doesn't have a lot of people. It just doesn't have any coho. But you drop down into the Puget Sound region, this is kind of a bigger issue, but, you know, there are actually a lot of coho in Puget Sound. Skagit, you know, there's a lot of coho there, but no one can fish because of the Thompson and fish off the oceans. So, to me, marine reserves are sort of a double down on the government taking away people's access to the fish. You know, I'm just using one example of one fish, the coho. You can talk about the canary, you can talk about the RCA. You know, and the other thing, too, is this idea that there's all this science and science. This comes from the federal government here. And they use this baseline canary rockfish at 26,000 tons, and they did it in 1916. Well, nobody believes that in 1916 the government knew how many canary rockfish were in the ocean, but that's the baseline everybody has to build up to. So all these baselines are basically a joke, really. You know, there's a lot of anger here. I'm speaking for a lot of people that are just angry with government, and coming here today doesn't help it. And that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you for sharing your comments, and thank you for coming here today. Let's see if there's any questions before you run off. Any questions for the panel? For these?
I have one. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Thompson. We talked on the phone yesterday, correct?
Yep, that's why I'm here. Thank you very much for calling.
And we talked about the fact of the impact on Garibaldi and what was the other one?
Lincoln City. Well, there's an impact in any time you put a marine reserve in, but some of them are more severe.
Do you think that this bill in its current form will be able to mitigate that impact and benefit? I mean, do you think that, let me rephrase it. Do you think that if these marine reserves are put into place to protect and enhance the fishery, that in the future they will do just that?
That's a great question. I'm going to say that I'm going to play a little bit of politics on you.
Oh, not it, here.
At this point, with what we have for knowledge, I don't think I can answer the question for sure. That's one of the reasons that we need to go slow and bring the Marine Reserves in so that we have good science behind us to make sure that we don't impact, because that's what the governor said, minimal on impact. I think there may be quite a bit of impact into Depot Bay, which is a very small community that is totally reliant on fisheries. But I don't have the science, and I want to make sure that science is done before it hurts the community.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming here today. We have three more people. Barbara Wilson, Gus Meyer, and Susan Allen. And then that's all that we have signed up to testify. Okay. Okay, maybe we didn't get the sheet. Okay, if you can go ahead and get started, because we're starting to run short on time.
Go ahead.
Okay. Flip a coin.
Yeah. And if you want to, if there was somebody over there that wanted to testify, why don't you come on up?
Go ahead. My name is Barbara Wilson. Chairperson Dingfelter and Vice Chair Senator Olson, thank you very much, and members of the committee, thank you for scheduling this hearing. I live in Beaverton, but I am at the coast frequently, and I'm a property owner in Tillamook County. I am very much interested in Senate Bill 1510, and I was particularly interested in the comments that you made to the Coastal Caucus about sustainability and how we need to move ahead with marine reserves for the generations that live at the coast, generations to come. I feel that this bill has been written very minimally, that we have not taken steps that will jeopardize socioeconomic factors on the coast. Senate Bill 1510 honors the work of the Marine Reserve Community Teams, designated Marine Reserve sites at Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua. It's appropriate honor for the over 25,000 volunteer hours that have been spent evaluating the ecological, social, and economic uses of these iconic areas. Once designated, these three sites, along with the marine reserve sites at Otter Rock and Red Fish Rocks, will create Oregon's first system of marine reserves. Now, during the discussion in 2009 on Bill, Senate Bill 3013, there were great input on the importance of marine reserves and how mature fish have higher levels of fertility, and especially rockfish. And when the marine reserves fills up with numbers of fish, they spill over into the other areas. So we're not talking about short-term. We're talking about long-term sustainability, which will benefit fishermen. We don't know everything that we need to know about the ocean and the ecology, and sometimes we make mistakes in overfishing. For example, I'm thinking specifically of rockfish and also sea urchins, which are used to send export to Asia. When we don't understand sustainability, we make mistakes on overfishing. And with the baseline data that's required in this bill, we will begin to learn more and how much fish can we take out without going beyond sustainability limits. Two elements of the bill tap into and further contribute to Oregon's long history of ocean stewardship. The legislation specifies that the boundaries and allowances within the sites are respected, consistent with the OPAC process, which was an exercise in public vetting and collaborative effort. And Senate Bill 1510 also calls for local resources and expertise to be used, providing opportunity for for long-term stewardship of coastal communities. The ocean belongs to all of us, and we will all benefit from protective, productive, healthy, and sustainable coastal waters. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sue?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Allen. I work for the Pew Charitable Trust, and I am the director of a coalition called Our Ocean. I'm speaking to you today in support of Senate Bill 1510, and would very much like to thank the time and energy and effort spent by coastal citizens, inland citizens, but most importantly, the Coastal Caucus, specifically Chair Cruz, Senator Johnson, and Representative Cowan for their good work in stewarding this very difficult issue. Senate Bill 1510 honors the compromises forged through the 25,000 volunteer hours spent in 2010 alone evaluating the sites at Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua. And really, we know that a plan for creating marine protected areas and reserves is most effective when it considers the needs of the whole state. So the time spent where ocean users, business leaders, conservationists, scientists worked to figure out what they had in common and were able to come up with a compromise that allows all of us to move together is notable. I think it's what Oregon does best, and the Oregon Marine Reserve planning process embodies this approach that Oregon takes on things and really represents the best way of moving forward in terms of public policy. Upon passage, Oregon may have an initial system of marine reserve sites that we can learn from. But it's also important to note that we have already learned a lot. I think that codification of this bill confirms that fishermen, Oregon fishermen, are conservationists, as are other stakeholder leaders, and we have found areas of common ground and mutual interest that we are looking forward to working on together as we move forward as a state. These relationships can only make our state stronger. And I appreciate the time to speak today.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, I have one. Ms. Allen, I see from your letterhead here your office is in Portland.
It's true, it is.
And you have one in Newport. Is that true?
We have, yes.
Okay, thank you. The question I have is, you see these marine reserves now as a beneficial aspect of our state, and I have a tendency to agree with you, except that we have fishermen, their livelihood is on the line. Do you anticipate through the development of these five areas that there will be further development of more areas in the future, or would that be your desire to see more reserve areas?
There are those that will tell you that this bill does not go far enough. And there will be those that say that there are areas of the state that need to be further considered. My hope, as we've moved forward with this process, is to focus on the areas that we have in common and move forward together to learn from those sites and apply what we learn to the other areas. I think Commissioner Thompson summed it up very well to say that there's lots about our nearshore that we don't know, but together we can look at what's happening in each of these sites, compare them, work with the stewardship of ODF&W, and move forward to apply those to other areas. The other thing that I want to make sure that you know is I am a lifelong fisherman. I love to fish. I fished with my father. It was some of the best time of my life. And I fish with my daughter. And I want my daughter to be able to fish with her granddaughter. So the whole idea of marine reserves is the same premise used in that duck hunters used in creating wildlife refuges, just areas for those females to crank out those babies so we have more babies that spread over and more of us can have fun harvesting them.
Follow up. Can you see the concern, though, of these stakeholders that are fishermen and what the impact on their families and their current families, their future families, and their businesses that they've built up?
Yes. Okay. As the daughter of a farmer who natural resource harvest is, it can be boon, it can be bust. And how well you manage those has everything to do with how many pairs of shoes you have that year.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming here today. We have Bob Horning, is that right? And Linda Buell. Okay. Linda Buell, is that anybody else would like to testify on this bill? I think you guys are the last ones up. If you have testimony, you can please give it to her. you could get started. We are really short on time. Thank you. And just a reminder to state your name for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Horning from North Plains, Oregon area. And thank you all, Senators and Madam Chair, for listening to us here. I am glad that the Cocoa Caucus was very, very forward in everything, saying that this has been a very, very tough, you know, thing to do here. It has been driven by, as they say, politics and everything for a long time here. And when I say politics, it is, you know, as Senator Johnson said, they are afraid of a ballot measure from the Pew Foundation. Now, last year, when we were fighting this here with House Bill, I think it was 2009, Representative Boone got up and asked Ms. Allen, who just spoke from Oceana, whether that, because there was a limit on how many reserves could be made, whether there would be any more, a lawsuit from Oceana. And Ms. Allen refused to answer the question, even though she was asked twice. So there is a lot of political pressure on the senators and the representatives to try to have something there to try to stop something. In my notes I handed out there, Oceana does list 31 sites that they would like to have eventually. You know, they say it right there.
Bob, I'm hearing what you're saying, but the person who just spoke represents, I think, a different organization.
No, Oceana. Or Pew Foundation, Oceana there.
She represents our ocean.
Okay.
Our ocean.
I'm hearing is something else. I'm just trying to connect you're attributing to her.
The same group.
Can I ask you, though, to speak to the bill? I don't want to get into a he said, she said.
Given
that we have limited time, prefer to hear what your views are on this piece of legislation.
Okay. My views are that I oppose it. For one, I've been to practically all of the Cape Falcon meetings and everything up there. To answer Senator Olson's question about enhanced fish stock and everything, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife said, no, this is not for fish enhancement. They were very specific. That's not for fish enhancement. It's to set aside natural areas for study. So everybody saying that this is for fish enhancement, it's not. It's not happening there. Now, it looks like it's going to be coming down, irregardless of what's going to happen here. What's happening, though, as far as the fishermen, they were 25% of the stakeholders in these groups, yet they have 100% of the impact happening to them. Now, if it's going to happen, at least what I'm asking for, in my personal view and everything else, is some sort of mitigation for them. Some sort of, you know, you look at what Bernie handed out as far as what's already limited to their fishing and everything, the RCAs and everything else. Open up some more fishing grounds for them. Give them something. Keep the communities alive. You're affecting people that's, you know, basically, you know, our fishermen supplying our food. Help them out. Give them some sort of mitigation. Don't just, you know, feed them to the wolves, which a lot of this stuff does. I know people don't want that to happen, but it is happening. So basically, in conclusion, I'm asking the senators and legislators to say no to politics, no to outside special interests, no to marine reserves if possible, no to making life harder to our middle-class workers, and at the very least, if it does go forward, I ask for mitigation and best representation you can give to our working families who are putting food on our table.
Thank you. Ms. Beal.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, and members of this committee for hearing our testimony. My name is Linda Buell, and I am the co-chair for the Fishermen's Advisory Committee for Tillamook. Our members sent a letter, and it's on file, opposing to quite a bit of the things that aren't mentioned in the bill. You say you will implement marine reserves and that there will be reports, but we don't know exactly what that means. I read the bill 7 times, and I still don't know what it means. Our family is owns Garibaldi Charters. During my father-in-law's time as a charter operator, that would be from the 70s to the 90s, there were 28 charter boats in Garibaldi. Right now there are 5. 2 of them are ours. And two of my children are charter captains, and I've got a marine biologist. It's a family thing. I would like to address, I guess, because you don't have time to hear everything, Cape Falcon in specific. There was a natural marine fisheries science environmental impact statement. We did hand it to the Cape Falcon people. It didn't seem to make a lot of difference. But in that assessment, and NIMS is National Marine Fisheries Science from NOAA, so it's like the premier science organization. And they did this environmental impact statement was about how fishing regulations affect communities. And on the whole, they did it for the whole West Coast, California, Washington, Oregon. And that paper, I believe it's on about page 16, they note that Garibaldi is the least resilient and most vulnerable city on the whole West Coast. It was out 88 cities that they did to any fishing regulation changes. Going from 28 charter boats to 5 charter boats shows that because there were a lot of regulations that came into play there. And I'm not sure that we'll still be here in 10 years. I would like to comment that we did take out over 2,000 tourists. We actually had a fairly good year last year. But most of those tourists, we realized, they do keep a big database, were from out of state. Quite a few were from California. The ones from California, several of the fishermen mentioned. I said, oh, you came a long way. Well, yeah, there's no place left to fish in California. They have a lot of marine reserves and MPAs, and that's why we're here. So there's another factor for Cape Falcon. North of Pacific City, there aren't very many reefs. So when you say we're only taking 6% of the ocean, in Garibaldi, that could be up to 20%. We've lost half our reefs by being cut to the 40-fathom line. And that puts us down to 6 reefs. Now they've brought it into the 30-fathom line. That takes care of one reef. And now Cape Falcon would take care of another reef, so we'd be down to 4. So I don't know how we can keep taking out the tourists that spend a lot of money in our community if Cape Falcon is implemented. I'm not sure what this implementation means, because if you implement it and then you do a report on it, then what happens? I mean, you don't have a sunset clause, though I consider that to be, or a non-performance clause. There are no goals listed in the bill either, or in the research. This makes a marine reserve productive. This makes it not productive. I don't see that anywhere. To me, there's a lot of things missing in the bill. However, I have to say that I do appreciate the Coastal Caucus working on it, and it's probably a better bill than we've gotten so far. So it still doesn't help Cape Falcon out, though. To me, it's not one of the areas that should be made into a marine reserve. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Well, let's see if there's any questions. Any questions for any of the witnesses? Thank you for coming here today. Okay, anybody else that would like to testify on this bill before we close the public hearing? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1510. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1510, and we'll be happy to take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move 1510 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 1510 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
This is one of these areas where we get into the group here have to make spur-of-the-moment decisions on bills that we've seen, and we definitely require the input that you folks give us. And it's a tough decision because on one hand you're dealing with families and livelihoods, and on the other hand you're dealing with saving the oceans and saving the fish. I commend the Coastal Caucus for the work they've done because they're in a tough position. If you don't do anything, does somebody else come in and do it for us? And if you do it, does it impact everybody's livelihood? Which it does. It happens every day. It's a really tough decision, and I think this is a hard one for me, but I think that we need to open this discussion to the floor, so I will be in favor of moving it to the floor.
Any other comments? Senator Przanski?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think following up with Senator Olson, I mean, the reality is it seems to me we got to do something. When I hear that the fisheries down in California have been closed down, it tells me that they've been overfished to the point of where they can't sustain it. And if we don't take some steps, and at this point, if we just sit here idle, we could find ourselves in the same situation, having everything being completely shut down. So it seems to me that this is a prudent step to take. I fully appreciate and understand how some people are going to be more directly impacted than others. But the reality is, if we just continue to, let's say, go forward without taking any action, we're going to potentially find ourselves with nothing at all. And so hopefully, through the work of the Coastal Caucus, the certified smart people who have been working this, will get answers and do what's best for all of us so we'll have something into longevity, even though it may have more of a direct impact on those today, but will allow for those in the future to still be able to benefit from the work of this these reserves. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
Yeah. Chuck, do you want to say? Okay. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say one more thing. Mm-hmm. I think this process, since we are in a short session, it's unfortunate that we have to move so quickly. I think that perhaps in the 2013 session, we could maybe look at some amendments to maybe make this a little sweeter to your taste. I'm not certain that we could do that, but
10 years ago.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you, Senator Przanski, for your comments. I'll just close the discussion by saying that we've been this issue has been worked on for about a decade. So even though it is a short session, there's been a lot of deliberation. What I'm hearing is the bill perfect no. I want to commend, again, the work of the Coastal Caucus, the amount of time and effort that you all have put into this along with the citizens of Oregon has been tremendous, and I think we will move forward together, and hopefully with the information that we get through this process, we'll be able to make sound decisions based on the science that we all are waiting to hear. Certainly, I think in order to make those decisions, though, we need to have that information, and that's what I see this bill doing in a prudent way. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator Hatch?
Yes.
Senator Pachauk?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice
Chair Olson? Aye. Aye. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Johnson, I was going to ask you and Senator Cruz to co-carry it on the floor.
On behalf of both of us, thank you.
Okay, thank you. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1510. And I'll let the room clear out for a minute, and then we're going to move on to Senate Bill 1511. We're going to keep going, so I'm going to have to ask you if you can follow up afterwards, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want to just hold 13 over since it's too late?
Depends on who's here, though. Ask them if they can come back. You want to do that?
I don't know if you can.
Right. Why don't you ask? If not, we can finish it. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1511. I just wanted to wait for the room to clear out because it is somewhat noisy. And Beth, if you can provide an overview of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1511 would add to the state statutory policy on ecosystem services. The bill directs the Governor's Office, working with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, to facilitate a review of relevant conservation plans that could affect ecosystem services and propose a process for such plans to be spatially aligned and coordinated. Directs the Institute for Natural Resources to provide information on public domain integrated ecosystem services methodologies that meet certain criteria, and authorizes state agencies and local governments to use ecosystem services credits for compensatory mitigation and water quality credit trading. There are some additional provisions that encourage OLEB to coordinate with others and authorize state agencies to purchase or receive credits for ecosystem services. There's no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued. You should have some emails and further testimony that was submitted in your packet.
Great. Thank you, Beth. And I'm going to call folks up in the essence of time. I'm going to once again ask you if you have written testimony, if you could just summarize it, because our first bill obviously took quite a bit longer than we expected. With that, I'm going to call up Sarah Vickerman, John Miller, and John McDonald. And I have to say, for the record, welcome John McDonald, who is my former boss.
Be nice.
It's great to see you.
Thank
Go ahead, Sarah. Whoever's going to start. We just need a microphone.
Since you've heard from me before last week, we have...
Microphone.
For the record, my name is Sarah Vickerman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to defer to these two gentlemen who were not here for the informational hearing. They may have something new and more interesting to say than I do.
Great. Thank you. Which John would like to go first? It's good to see you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John McDonald. I am a farmer. I raise hazelnuts in a little place next to a village called Hillsboro. And thank you for the invitation. Appreciate being good to see you again. I strongly encourage passage of Senate Bill 1511. My experience with ecosystem services and markets takes several forms. I have an ecosystem service project on my farm at the present time, helping mitigate a public agency's needs. I'm chair of the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District, which has run an ecosystem service program since 2004, and I'm say quite successfully. I'm also treasurer of the Willamette Partnership, which is building tools to be able to spread ecosystem services to other places. And I'm on the National Association of Conservation Districts Executive Board and Farm Bill Policy Board, advocating for things such as this. I think we farmers are doing a pretty good job of raising a lot of things, including healthy soil, keeping water clean, and making homes for fish and wildlife. When we take care of the land, we are contributing to a healthy economy, ecology, and good communities. And we have a strong conservation ethic, and this bill is designed along the way to help us implement that. It would be totally stupid and self-defeating of us not to take care of our natural resources. We depend on them for our living. If you own a business, I can't imagine you're running through your operations, smashing computers, burning office furniture, and punching holes in the tires of delivery trucks. Ecosystem service programs create some new revenue options for farmers as they diversify their business. A number of us farmers in the Tualatin watershed are saving wastewater ratepayers of Washington County tens of millions of dollars a year. In this case, we farmers are getting paid a little to do that. The program is a complex relationship, partnership of Farm Service Agency, Clean Water Services, Tualatin Soil Water Conservation District, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and landowners. Farmers get annual rental payments of about $300 an acre to lease the riparian area for restoration. We're spreading it now into Medford. This bill opens the door for more conversations about how to expand some of these early successes. The work being done here in Oregon has caught the attention of farm groups nationally. USDA has invested millions of dollars around here in Oregon. The Secretary of Agriculture of USDA is speaking very highly of us. In fact, 2 days ago in Nevada, I happened to meet James Gore, who is the Special Assistant to the Chief, Dave White, and we talked about the programs and how they're trying to implement such a thing on the national scale. And I've got him coming out here in July to do another tour of Oregon and how well we're doing it. That reputation puts Oregon farmers at an advantage. But I've been on this task force drafting, you know, some of this farm bill stuff, and I can tell you conservation is going to take a big hit, along with the Title I direct payments. In my humble opinion, please, Madam Chair, don't say that.
No comment.
No rebuttal. Ecosystem service markets are a better way of wisely applying the public's money to get cost-benefit results. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming here today. Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is John Miller. I'm president of Wildwood Wahonia, which is a group of companies here in the Salem area. A copy of my testimony is in your packet, I believe. I have an odd combination of jobs. I'm a farmer and an urban developer. In fact, here in Salem, we have one residential community that's right across the fence from our nursery and vineyard. I shake my fist at myself sometimes across the fence, but they do well together. Our companies have developed many projects which have created jobs and made places for companies that create jobs in food processing and biofuels, production offices, commercial developments. So I kind of understand things on both sides of the urban growth boundary. And whether I'm wearing my urban hat or my rural hat, I'm supporting Senate Bill 1511. It's good for urban and rural businesses and the environment, and I care for all three. In planning and developing urban properties, there's regulations that some are outdated, they're complex, they're expensive, and they don't often reach the goal that they're established to do. Senate Bill 1511 allows some flexibility in terms of regulators to be able to allow alternate paths to meet those regulations without taking the landowner's feet away from the fire. So often it's really frustrating for the regulated and the regulator to have this prescribed path that allows no flexibility, even when both can see a solution that's down the road and somewhat better. Putting on my farmer's hat, I know that the approach that is put into 1511 provides new markets for agriculture, and ecosystem services are the way to provide those markets. Often, ecosystem services are best suited to wet lands that are low along rivers. We have a farm in the Willamette Valley, in fact, in Polk County on the Willamette. If you look at it right now, a good portion of it is still underwater, and it will stay that way, or it'll stay wet, and it's not the most productive part of that farm. In fact, it's probably the least, but it's probably the most well-suited to ecosystem services. So allowing this option allows us to use those lands that are the first one you have to get off in the fall and the last one you can get on in the spring. So, and Senate Bill 1511 does this with no fiscal impact. So no matter what hat I'm wearing, especially my taxpayer's hat, I support it completely. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from this panel?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
If you don't mind. Mr. McDonald, you say you do lease some of your farmland out for ecosystem management?
Yes, sir. Senator Olson, that is correct.
When you lease that out, do you give up, or do you have a conservation easement then? Or is anybody, can you use that land, or is that land given to those that have received the lease?
Chair Dingfinger, Senator Olson, no, I do not use the land for farming. I do not produce a crop on that land. I am actually in the process of putting an easement on it. Have not got so yet. But it is it serves the purpose of the project for the ecosystem services all.
Follow up. So what kind of documentation happens when someone buys a lease on your land and provides for wetland mitigation? Is there a legal document that's recorded with the county or anything saying that these folks now have leased this land and they are responsible for it? Or
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, it's not in the form of a lease that is actually recorded in the county offices. It is a contract. And the contract is with the United States Department of Agriculture, Clean Water Services, and the State of Oregon.
Okay. It's a follow-up.
When it becomes an easement, of course, it would be recorded in the county record.
Okay, I do have a follow-up. Mm-hmm. So then, this bill, is this going to create an agency that's going to you're going to eliminate the United States of America and the State of Oregon? We're going to go just to this nonprofit agency, like a watershed enhancement board or something like that. Will this create an agency to do that?
Excuse me, Senator Olson, are you asking me?
Yeah, if you know the answer. I don't know the answer, so I...
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, what it does is it allows state agencies and others to begin to utilize their resources by applying some of the plans that have already been developed about where things need to happen to protect our natural resources and wildlife habitat and so forth, and to be able to work with individual landowners to exchange these funds for the services that would be purchased, which we call ecosystem services. There's a benefit. It's kind of like it's a marketplace. There's a buyer and there's a seller. And we arrive at a product and we negotiate a fair price and we make the transaction. And that's essentially what allows the state agencies to negotiate with people and to use taxpayer funds to purchase these services.
Follow up.
Actually, it allows, as John Miller mentioned, the flexibility. It allows the negotiation on specific things that sometimes, frankly, we are not getting through what some of these programs dictate and the rules and stuff that go along with it. I think we do a better job this other way.
I guess my biggest concern is the fact that we are creating a market with no defined product and no defined price. And it concerns me as we go down the road with this thing, because as I read this, it opened the door to regulation with no rules of the regulation, no specifics, nothing specifically determined. So it concerns me that, you know, you said you get $300 an acre. In the future, as acreage is leased and we get less of it, the price goes up. Is there going to be an indeterminate cost on this? Once everybody's land is leased, where does it go from here?
Do you want to say something?
Senator Olson, yes. You wouldn't want the legislature setting a price.
Can you say your name, please?
Sorry, Sarah Vickerman, Defenders of Wildlife. You wouldn't want the legislature setting a price for these services. If there's a market for ecosystem services, just like if there's a market for wheat or cars or something else, the market sets the price. There are programs that provide payments for ecosystem services in which a government agency or a private entity or whoever's interested in these services can pay a landowner to provide X acres of wildlife habitat or clean water benefits or something like that. But once again, those are prices that are determined by the buyer and the seller, and when they agree, the transaction takes place. And so, in response to the regulation, this bill does not create any new regulations. Sometimes regulations are the driver for these markets. Like the wetland regulations are the ones that create a demand for credits in, say, a wetland mitigation bank. But this does not impose any new regulations, nor does it alleviate the responsibility of anybody who's currently regulated to meet the intent of those regulations. It opens the door to a different conversation about how the activities that are undertaken can be more effective, can produce greater benefits, and be more efficient with lower transaction costs and happen more quickly and more efficiently.
Chair Dingfelder, I'd like to add a little bit to that, and that is I mentioned I'm a treasurer of a thing called Willamette Partnership. That is actually a body of people. We're a public 501c3. We are in the process of doing the research to design the processes, the metrics, the protocols, the platforms, in order to be able to determine what is the value of an ecosystem service. We've already done so for a couple of things. I mean, our project in the 12 SWCD determined a value for a meeting a temperature standard, which was placed upon clean water services by EPA. We're now into valuing what is the value of an acre of wetlands, what is the value of an acre of a riparian area, what is the value of a nutrient program that is reducing the amount of nutrients being put on the ground and protecting stuff going into the water. So those kinds of very calculated things are being studied, researched, and so forth. But again, it is establishing a price for the product and then looking for a buyer and a seller to make the transaction.
And just to follow up, in the end, you as a farmer, this may offset some of the costs for you to comply with these regulations, or if you do improvements on your property, it's my understanding, it will actually offset some of the costs that you may invest in the long term.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Chair, that is correct.
The way that I read this bill, there is no fiscal, there's a minimal fiscal statement, so I don't believe that there would be creation. If anything, it is within our existing agencies. As you've heard, there's, if anything, a creation of new jobs through either 501c3 or private entities that are interested in these transactions. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Chair Dingfelder, one of the confusions is we have experience over the last 10 years of running this kind of a marketplace business, but it's going to take, as it's taking in a lot of places in the United States, some time to learn how to do this way of doing business. I mean, the way we've done it in the past has been successful and it has its set of failures, but this is a new way of negotiating the use of public funds to obtain what we want to do on the land. And it's going to take some time to get even accustomed to the concept of how this business works. All I know is we've been operating it for 10 years, we've got the metrics working, and we have great confidence that it will be successful.
Great. Okay, one last, we're running out of time, right. So one last word, and then we're going to move on to the next panel.
Just one comment on the public funds aspect. Actually, it could be private funds. A private company could have an obligation for temperature, contract with a farmer to plant trees to shade a stream, and there'd be no public funds whatsoever involved, and the company might find that a bargain compared to building a big concrete and steel plant of some kind.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to call up, so Jeff Stone, is Jeff here?
I don't think so.
Jeff had to leave. Oh. Richard Kosasan. We have Roger Beyer and Jim Myron. Okay, gentlemen, you could be expedient because we are running out short of time. I know you can all talk fast as lobbyists. Richard, why don't you go ahead first? Is there on that end? You'll need a microphone, though, first.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. And albeit there may be some positive concepts embodied in the proposal, we would object to the proposal as currently put together. One of the previous speakers indicated that the legislature should not be in the situation of setting a price. But the way I would view this legislation, if one were to turn to specifically Section 6, the state agency may purchase or receive credits for ecosystem services. So when you have a state agency acquiring via purchase or acquisition in some other form a credit, that agency, in terms of potential, albeit positive, mitigation down the road, the agency may be in the place of setting the market value for those credits. The way the bill is constructed, again, Section 6, a state agency may purchase or receive credits for ecosystem services. And if we look at the definition of ecosystem services promulgated, I believe, in 2009 with the passage of Senate Bill 513, ecosystem service means the benefits that human communities enjoy as a result of natural processes and biological diversity. I believe, with respect to those provisions, it serves as an example. I think further clarification to the overall measure would be very beneficial.
Thank you, Richard.
Madam Chair, I will, at your kind of suggestion, I'll quit there.
Okay, thank you. Jim.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon and the Native Fish Society. You have our written testimony, I believe. Let me just quickly summarize by saying Water Watch is opposed to this bill. The bill that was passed 3 years ago already provides the necessary mechanism for state agencies to begin getting involved in these ecosystem transactions. So we don't think that the bill in front of you today adds any more to that existing process. What we don't see in the bill is any meaningful standards for state agencies to use to develop these processes. And if you wanted to do something positive, this would be an addition we would like to see. So based upon that, we cannot support the bill at this point in time. And for Native Fish Society, Native Fish Society also concurs with the Water Watch statement. And Native Fish Society also has some specific concerns about language in the bill that to us can be read to say that you don't necessarily have to protect certain areas as long as you mitigate for the damage you're doing somewhere, not necessarily even in the same area. So that concept is certainly not consistent with the idea of protecting and restoring native fish stocks, where all the remnant populations of native fish that are still there need to be protected. You can't just eliminate some of them because it's not convenient or is the likelihood of success is less than somewhere else. So we're opposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Oregon Seed Council. I checked neutral on the bill because I don't exactly know how I feel about this bill right at the moment. John McDonald's testimony kind of summed it up, where he's for 10 years been doing this already, and I'm trying to figure out what this bill has in it that's going to make it work better, because I can't see it in the bill. And I don't understand what the goal of the bill is. So if that's why I check neutral, I'm still trying to get my arms around what this thing actually does. Specifically under Section 5, I was going to sit here next to Katie Fast of the Farm Bureau, echoing some concerns of the language in Section 5, the grant section of the bill. She's not here to make that statement, so I guess I'm making it for her that Katie Fast of Oregon Farm Bureau has some concerns, and we would echo those same concerns specifically with Section 5 of the bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for this gentleman?
Question.
Senator Brzozinski.
I'm looking at some testimony that was given in front of the House Energy, Environment, and Water back on April in 2011, so the last session. There was a similar bill that was before us, or before them, I should say, and it looks like the Farm Bureau said that they agreed with the Dash 3s. I understand the bill that was before us is basically the Dash 3s. Can someone help me and tell me if that's not correct?
I'm not sure any of these folks can answer it. I think Sarah can. So, okay. We'll have Sarah come back up and answer that.
All right. The reason I asked that is because Sean was here for the Farm Bureau, and it says that they supported the Dash 3. So I just need clarification if there's a change.
Okay. All right. Sarah, why don't you come up and answer that? Thank you, gentlemen. And then we'll have Sarah answer that, and we'll hear from the last folks.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Dinkfelder, Sarah Vickerman for the record. What you have before you is the typewritten version of the oral testimony to the House Environment Committee on House Bill 3109, which is virtually Dash 3s, which is virtually identical to the bill before you now.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right, thank you. So Bill Hoyt, is that right? Am I saying that right? And Jim Welsh and John Chandler, I think, is up next. And just to let you know, in the essence of time, we're going to close the public hearing on this in just a minute, open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1513, because we have some people who came from far away that cannot come back. And then we'll see if we have time to reopen work session or hold it over till next time. So. Go ahead,
Thank
Jim.
You, Chair Dean Feller, Jim Welsh, Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Bill Hoyt had to leave. He's our past president. But we have some concerns. I know we put down on there that we oppose this, but this is our first time to talk about this, I think, and give any testimony coming from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association on this issue. And we are not understanding exactly how the benefits will come to us and as landowners and as ranchers. And we already are doing everything we can to comply with the regulation around water quality and treatment of our land. And we work with the SWCDs, Watershed Councils, and within state rule and law. And we have done, I think, tremendous things on our landscape, and we have compiled a number of those things, even now putting those into a CD that we can share with everybody. And we look at this and we go, do we really need it? Is this needed? And what is the benefit? And then after we ask that question and can't answer it because we really don't know yet, what about a pilot program? We could place something like this into a pilot program and see if there's really going to be an involvement. And at this point in time, we think it's probably better suited in the private sector. And what about a sunset clause on it? If it's not working, let's get rid of it if you decide to move it on and if there's a lot of legislative support for it. But at this point in time, we don't see the benefit for us. So
thank you for your testimony. And Emily, I'm going to ask you to come up because we have another chair up here. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. In the interest of time, I will not whack Mr. Welch for uttering the words task force, which I had pledged to do this session. We were here earlier. We continue to support the bill. We've submitted written testimony. I'd be more than happy to repeat my cogent and hopefully persuasive words at this point, but I commend the bill to you. I think it'll give us a valuable set of tools for those of us stuck in a regulatory limbo so often. Glad to take questions. Good bill.
And we hear from Emily first, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Emily Ackland. I'm the Environmental Policy Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. The Association of Oregon Counties supports Senate Bill 1511. We feel the biggest benefit of a market-based approach for ecosystem restoration is that it addresses the need for improved efficiency, focused investments, and more consistent management of mitigation and restoration projects. This bill supports greater flexibility for complying with environmental laws, and it encourages state agencies and local governments to use approaches that could be more beneficial to the environment than current practices. Again, we support this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for this panel?
I have a quick question. Do you know where the federal government is on this issue as a, with different regulations with the Army Corps and the DSL? Do you know where the would this fit in the federal programs too when people are dealing with issues like this?
Sure, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Thompson. I do know that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working on something to do with markets, ecosystem services, and probably Sarah would be the better one to to answer that question.
Sarah, do you want to come up and answer that?
Senator Thompson, Chair Dingfelder, there's a very close relationship between what the federal agencies do and what the state does relative particularly to mitigation. So a lot of the drivers for this market-based activity come from federal statutes, the Clean Water Act, the Federal Endangered Species Act. And an example would be that there's a bird called a sage grouse in eastern Oregon that is not yet listed but could be listed. In anticipation of a potential listing and as part of an effort to avoid a listing and all the adverse impacts that landowners experience with a listed species, the Fish and Wildlife Service is working with the state and with local government to develop what is sometimes called pre-compliance market or candidate conservation banking. And to answer the questions raised by the gentleman from the Cattlemen's Association, in an arrangement like this, a private landowner that owns rangelands in eastern Oregon would be able to sell sage-grouse credits to a buyer who might be, say, a wind energy developer that's causing an impact in another location, and receive assurances from the Fish and Wildlife Service through an agreement called a Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances that would protect X amount of sage-grouse habitat in order to offset the adverse impact in another location. So this, in this case, the rancher would be a direct beneficiary of a payment for these services for this wildlife habitat.
Yes. Go ahead.
No. Well, I just got to be having my
yeah.
Three.
So any other quick questions? Because we have one more bill we need to
yes,
hear.
Yes, I do have a quick question.
Okay.
It was interesting that you brought up the sage-grouse mitigation. Basically, what it is then is we have a problem. We pay somebody else to take care of that problem, and the problem still exists. But over here, we get the sage-grouse can still live, but over here they can't live because we've got this energy facility. And basically, what this says to me, and reading from Senate Bill 513, Ecosystem Services and Markets Executive Summary, innovative programs are emerging that focus on payments for ecosystem services and ecosystem service markets. These programs attach value to nature's benefits and calculate that value in monetary units, then bring buyers and sellers together to trade ecosystem services for financial payments. Now, it also says in this bill that agencies can buy those credits. So basically, the agency regulates the individual to what they have to do, and then they turn around, and then they can turn around and sell them the credit to advance themselves, to provide themselves with money, dollars.
Senator Olson, typically would be different agencies involved. For example, if the Department of Transportation is building roads that cause an impact to some ecosystem service, then they can purchase credits from a private landowner, from whoever, to offset the credits. And in the case of agencies buying ecosystem service credits, that would be one example. Another would be with an agency like the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that makes grants now to do conservation projects on private land. An alternative way to proceed would be to buy the ecosystem service credits and then retire them, so there would be no, it wouldn't be part of a mitigation program, it would just be part of an investment in ecosystem services.
So I'm going to have to ask you to follow up with Senator Olson after this, after the committee, because we've run out of time. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1511. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1513, because we have some people came here and are not able to come back next week. So I want to make sure that they don't have to drive back here. We have, actually, David, why don't you come up? David Piltz and Tony Malmberg, is that my, I hope I'm saying that right. And then we'll adjourn that hearing and we'll reopen it up next Tuesday on the 7th, is that right?
Yeah.
When we have a little bit more time. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if we're going to have time for the full PowerPoint.
It's short.
Is it short?
It's fine.
Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, thank you all for the opportunity. For the record, David Pills, Freshwater Trust, Flow Restoration
Can
Director.
Can you pull up the mic? We're having a hard time hearing you. David Pills.
I'll be really brief since we are running out of time. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1513. Split season leasing is a very powerful tool, and it provides a potential win-win both for landowners and for freshwater ecosystems. At the same time, it's a really simple bill. We're just asking to remove a sunset on a piece of law that already exists and is a tool that's being used to success across the state right now. And also, it's a pretty palatable bill because there's no fiscal impact. If anything, it's a fee-based program. And so in order to participate, you have to pay a fee. So we think it's a perfect bill for this session. And we also think it's, in light of Oregon's coming integrated water resource strategy, this is exactly the kind of tool we need to keep in place in perpetuity. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry to be so rushed.
Madam Chair, you heard we had a little Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I ranch in Union County, Oregon. This is a...
Oh, can you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, excuse me. Tony Malmberg, Malmberg. this is a picture of our place where we winter cattle right out of Union. The highway on the right-hand side there on the top goes to La Grande. On the bottom goes to North Powder. You see a green outline there is a 20-acre alfalfa field. We can make more money and manage our resources better by leasing the water for the third cutting for in-stream flow for salmon habitat. The first two cuttings make more money raising hay. And the reason for that can be demonstrated by this actual growth rate of plants that we have where we summer our cattle east of Elgin, Oregon. A cool season plant grows many factors, but one of the major factors is based on the temperature, the ambient temperature. That top line you see there marks the average ambient temperature in Elgin, Oregon. That's also the exact same temperature as John Day, Oregon. So a cool season plant basically starts to shut down when the ambient temperature reaches 60 degrees and shuts down at 70 degrees temperature. So we all know, all ranchers know, that they grow a lot more grass and hay in May and June than they do July and August. And this is the reason why. Plants just don't grow. I mean, cool season plants just don't grow in hot weather. The Pacific Northwest is primarily cool season grasses. So how's that look? If you take the irrigation efficiency tables, this blue column is how much water it takes to grow these different cuttings of hay. You can see it takes almost six times as much water to grow the same amount of hay in the third cutting in late July, August, than it does in the first two cuttings. When you put the money, the dollars to it, for what I can lease that water to, the value of the water. You look at our resource base, you know, ranchers are in the business of adding value to their resources, their soil, the water, capturing sunlight energy, and that. And we've never had a value of water before. We always viewed it as free. But now that there's value to it, we can allocate that resource and how to manage it better. So if you look at this in the first cutting, we have about $42 of water that we grow over $200 net value of hay. The second cutting, we have about $55 of water that we can grow over $100 worth of hay. And in the third cutting, it would take about $95 to grow $37 worth of hay. So I can allocate that resource to the river, improve the fish habitat, and it makes more money for my water resource. And here's the difference to our little small 20-acre field. Less than $1,000 if you cut the third cutting hay, and the water makes over $3,000. Now, I understand that there's a proposed amendment to this bill to push the sunset back. And I'm also, after I did this, works so good, I took a job with the Freshwater Trust, and I work in the John Day Basin. And I have a person I work with over there, a young rancher, that is waiting to see how this legislation comes out so he can buy a place, he and his wife and young daughter. But he needs to be able to amortize this water lease in to buy the place. It helps him manage his cash flow for how he buys it. For example, if he were to get a 20 or 30 year loan on to buy the place, he would want to do a 20 or 30 year split season lease, so he would have that guaranteed income coming in to help pay for the loan.
So what I'm hearing is the longer the period of certainty for a rancher or farmer, the better their ability to predict their income for the future. So we are just about to be kicked out of this room. I just want to make sure that you get to say all your points, because I know you can't come back.
Yes, I'm finished.
Okay, and see if there's any questions, because I know you can't come back. Senator Thompson?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Chair Dingfelder. I guess my only question, are you a senior water right user, or are you a junior water right user? Do you know that for sure in that spot?
In Union, where our water is, I have a 1873 water right, and the more senior rights are pre-1870.
Okay, I'm a pear grower from Hood River. So I've got some experience with water usage. My only concern on this bill, one of my concerns would be, what you're the senior water right guy, and you have on downstream you got some junior water rights. But if at some point you decide from perpetuity to do a split water right on a really lean water year, on a drought year or something, how will that, and it goes back in stream, how?
David, can
What's
you answer
that,
please?
Downstream?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, that's a good question. Leases can only be approved in five-year terms. We can write contracts with people to do a 30-year lease by saying we'll do a succession of five-year leases. But to be more specific on your point, these leases, the Water Resource Department, and when they testify on this, I'm sure they'll tell you this, but they analyze each of these leases to ensure that there's no third-party impacts that could not have happened under, you know, irrigation of the water right. So in other words, their basic test is no injury to other water users and no enlargement of the water right when it goes into a lease like this. So we rely on the Water Resource Department to protect, and they do a good job of protecting others.
And I'll ask the Water Resources Department to follow up with Senator Thompson. One last question.
There's no five-year timeline. There's no.
That's currently in regulations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
I have a question. If you don't want to. Sir, you mentioned that this gentleman wanted to buy this ranch and he wanted to incorporate this into there. If he's able to lease this out, but we have lean water years and there'll be an impact of junior users, that would affect his ability to pay his mortgage, because he can't, and then he wouldn't be able to, would be allowed to lease that water out because it would impact junior users?
No, as David said, the Water Resource Department manages that all up front. what his interest is having this lease for a long enough period so he can plan that income, the increased income, to go towards payments of the land.
Well, my point being, if there is a short water year and the water department comes back and says, no, we're not going to allow you to lease that this year, then that's going to impact his payment.
Vice Chair Olson, thank you. We take the risk on that as the people who are compensating irrigators. If I compensate this gentleman for a 20-year lease and some of those years it doesn't go in stream, that's okay. We take that risk and don't
ask
them.
You say we.
The Freshwater Trust and those of us that do this work take the risk. So we pay them the same no matter what.
Well, I do have one question. In the OARs, 690-077-0079, it says the commission will review the split season use leasing program no later than the year 2014 to determine any changes should be made in the program. So why do we want to sunset this now and not let the commission do it as they're supposed to by law?
Senator Olson, thank you for that question. I'm seeing a lot of new interest in this program in the last few years. As Tony told you, he has a few folks in the John Day that are really interested. I have probably another 8 or 9 folks in the 15-mile basin next door to Senator Thompson's. Really, it's a matter of a lot of interest in this program and wanting to be able to provide some of these landowners with certainty and get some of these projects on the ground now.
Okay. All right, with that, we are out of time, and let me make sure I close the right work session, or the public hearing. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1513, and we will close the committee and see you next week.